You know, on one hand, it's retaliation against something that Disney said. And that is quintessential no-no under the First Amendment. You're not supposed to, you know, retaliate against someone for someone's speech.
Welcome to the Powers That Be Daily, Puck's podcast focused on the intersection of Wall Street, Washington, Silicon Valley, and Hollywood, and the players who run it all. I'm Peter Hamby. It's Tuesday, May 9th. Today, I'm joined by Eric Gardner to talk about the ongoing legal war between Ron DeSantis and Disney. With DeSantis set to launch a presidential campaign in the coming weeks, Eric explains why this chapter in the war on wokeness could end up in the Supreme Court. And later, Bill Cohan and Ben Landy game out what Warren Buffett was really thinking when he became the biggest shareholder in Paramount, which just lost billions of dollars in value. Is there still an exit strategy for Buffett and a Hollywood ending for Sherry Redstone? We'll discuss all that and more on today's episode of The Powers That Be. Quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on multiple systems, on delivering your product or service, the more margin you have and the more money you keep. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified business management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move, so do the math. See how you profit with NetSuite. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/powersthatbe, netsuite.com/powersthatbe. That's netsuite.com/powersthatbe. Happy Tuesday, everybody. It seems like, according to various reports, that Ron DeSantis is going to enter the presidential race at some point in the next few weeks. But in his home state of Florida, DeSantis is waging an ongoing war against Disney over quote-unquote wokeness and the Don't Say Gay bill. I think a lot of people out there know this is happening, but don't totally understand some of the legal aspects of this fight. And so, as the sun rises on DeSantis 2024, I thought Eric Gardner would be a great guest today to help us understand what this lawsuit is. Who's up? Who's down? What are the stakes? Eric, how are you, man?
I'm doing great.
So we know this goes back to the Don't Say Gay bill, which was a bill DeSantis passed with the help of the Florida Republican-controlled legislature to basically ban discussions around sexuality, gender, elementary schoolers. And it actually empowered parents to sue schools and educators over this. DeSantis has made that signature of part of his campaign against wokeness. Florida is, in his words, where woke goes to die. But take us back to the beginning of this case. What happened that set off this fight?
Yes, that's right. Florida had passed a new law, basically about what could be taught in classrooms and, you know, what topics were verboten. And at first, Disney, you know, was being very politically careful about it, but it had some of its own employees kind of speak up about it and put pressure on leaders. And then eventually Disney made their own stance about it. And then DeSantis kind of reacted to that. And he said, you know, this is an example of a woke company. And he kind of, you know, seized the opportunity to, you know, stoke the culture wars and kind of used Disney as his punching bag. So it's escalated for months and months and months. And one thing that DeSantis has been harping on about is how Disney World is some sort of fiefdom where, you know, Disney has written the laws and chosen whether to enforce those laws and has its own district. And so, you know, in response to the wokeness of Disney, got his people at the Florida legislature to pass a law and to kind of like retake the area around Disney World. That was scheduled to happen earlier this year. And right before it did happen, Disney used still control over the board to pass some last minute stuff, land use development contracts that let them, you know, basically do whatever they want for the next 10 years. And when that came public, you know, everything hit the fan. It just, you know, exploded, and now it's in litigation.
So we know that in many states, especially Republican states, you know, governors create tax breaks and incentives for companies to come there and thrive there and, you know, leave Illinois and leave California and leave New York, come to Florida, come to South Carolina, etc. One element of this I don't totally understand, though, is this special development zone. And what power does Disney have? What sort of independence, rather, does Disney have with this zone going back to like the 60s? And then what control does the state of Florida have over the zone? And what exemptions does Disney have? This is all sort of confusing to me.
Right. If you took away the DeSantis stuff and the culture war stuff, I think, you know, one could make a good case that Disney should not have this self-governing district. Now, what happened was that, you know, Disney took over this area, and Disney argued that it needed extreme latitude to build up as quickly as possible. And this district basically gave them the ability to invest a lot of money in Disney World to basically like move forward really fast, without, you know, going through the bureaucracy of zoning and all that. So there are good reasons for it, and there are reasons against it. It's true that there's not many areas in this country that are kind of like self-governing districts where the corporation gets to, you know, basically right. rule. And Disney has it, and this has been there for decades. And it hasn't been too much of a problem over this time. I bet most people didn't even realize that this was the state of being until very recently. As part of this culture war thing, you know, DeSantis decided to point it out and basically rip it away from Disney. And that's where, you know, some of the like tough legal questions start coming in, because, you know, on one hand, it's retaliation against something that Disney said. And that is quintessential no-no under the First Amendment. You're not supposed to, you know, retaliate against someone for someone's speech. On the other hand, it might be a good rationale to say, you know, Disney shouldn't have these breaks if Universal doesn't at the nearby Universal Studios. Companies should be on equal footing. So if it was just purely that rationale, I think that DeSantis would be, you know, within his, you know, right to grab back this area and say Disney shouldn't have these breaks. The problem is that it got messed up in a lot of this other stuff. And now Disney is basically suing and saying, you know, you're violating our rights. And you're doing this against the First Amendment. You're taking you know, our valuable property without compensation. And that's where the intrigue begins.
Does the park, at least in Florida, pay taxes, though, to the state of Florida?
There are taxes paid. There are certain tax advantages to the whole program. But as far as I understand it, there are still, you know, lots of taxes paid. You know, Florida is a state where famously there's no, you know, state income tax, and they rely heavily on, you know, tourism dollars and taxes that tourists pay. So obviously you stay in a Disney resort, you're going to pay taxes. The people who work at Disney World, they, you know, go out and they spend things, and they pay sales taxes, and there's many different ways where Disney World contributes to the economy of Florida, and that contributes tax revenue as well. So, you know, I don't think that Florida has much of an argument to say that Disney is winning financially against them. I think it's more of a question of power and control. I mean, DeSantis and the people in the Florida government, they say, you know, Disney has, you know, passed all these fire codes, but, you know, they're not really enforcing the fire codes. And shouldn't there be an independent governance body that comes in and does that sort of thing and looks after it? And, you know, it's a good point. The problem is just how everything went down, not necessarily that they don't have a good point to begin with.
Some of the political analysis of this stuff, I slightly disagree with. Like, it's not great if DeSantis loses a fight with Disney. Disney has 80,000 employees in the state of Florida. They're one of the most popular brands in the entire world. But I think the thing that Republican primary voters at least notionally
are aware of is DeSantis is at war with Disney over wokeness. The reason I don't think there'll be like a ton of political fallout for him if he loses this lawsuit in the courts is the lawsuit is about these arcane things like land use and governing boards and bonds. What is the lawsuit itself and what is the status of it?
Yeah, first of all, I disagree with you slightly. You know, okay. I think that for a certain, you know, a portion of the Republican electorate, yes, it's all about wokeness. But I think there's also a portion of the Republican electorate that cares about good business and and cares about being an effective leader. And I think that to the extent that DeSantis is losing a battle with Disney, I think that reflects poorly on him. As for the lawsuit, you know, I think that it's being primarily examined right now from a First Amendment perspective. But honestly, I think that real legal issues is about where this is going to play out. Disney filed a lawsuit in federal court because plainly they wanted to dodge all of DeSantis's appointed judges. And the question really is that a proper maneuver? Mm-hmm. DeSantis and Florida, they filed in state court. They're suing Disney as well. And, you know, they basically saying that this is a local issue. And mm-hmm. so I think for the next year, we're going to have like, you know, a back and forth that plays out about who actually has jurisdiction over this battle. It's not going to be about the merits of the case and you know, who is right and what were the reasons, but it's just going to be about, you know, where this plays out. And, you know, this is the sort of issue that could go to the Supreme Court. Eventually, it will get to the merits and the question of whether Disney's First Amendment rights were violated. And in that respect, the interesting legal part is going to be, you know, when there's mixed motives, what does that mean? DeSantis might have had as part of his motive to retaliate against Disney, against its expression. But he also, you know, might have been of the mind that, you know, no company should have special advantages over the other. And so it's, mm-hmm. the question will be, you know, he has good motives and he has bad motives, which are the ones that kind of outweigh the other. And so it's a very, very interesting legal fight. And I think this one's going to be going on for years.
You are right, though, I should point out, like in my time, at least covering Republican governors, like I did it for so many years before Trump came along, spend time with Chris Christie and Nikki Haley and Rick Perry and like that generation of Republican governors, like the Chamber of Commerce, pro-business crowd was like more important than the NRA and the Baptist Church for certain Republicans. And like the idea of a Republican governor in a low tax right to work state going hard at like one of the most like popular private companies in a state is very much a departure from past Republican politics. But you know, wokeness, it does some crazy stuff. Eric, thank you so much, man.
My pleasure.
Hey, Powers That Be listeners, I'm here to tell you that there's no reason to panic the next time you're searching for the perfect gift. Now you can use Gift Mode on Etsy. Gift Mode on Etsy takes the stress out of gifting so you can find the perfect item for anyone and any occasion. It's easy. Just tap or click Gift Mode on your Etsy app or Etsy.com. Then answer a few short questions about who you're shopping for and what they like. And Gift Mode instantly gives you a curated list of gift ideas based on hundreds of personas. I use Etsy all the time and have for years. I bought my brother some artwork. I bought my wife some jewelry. I even bought a rug for our living room on Etsy. I love it. But there's a lot of pressure around gifting. I usually have a hard time thinking of gift ideas for friends and family members around the holidays or birthdays in my life. And sometimes I get super stressed trying to find the perfect thing. But now with Gift Mode on Etsy, I can search hundreds of gifting personas and find so many incredible items. And I actually just found the perfect gift for a buddy who's just as into Cincinnati sports as I am, a hot cup of Joe Burrow mug. That's right, I found that on Etsy. It's amazing. Now it's simple to find gifts made by independent sellers for all the people in your life. So whether you need a housewarming gift for the new homeowner or a birthday present for the pickleballer, Gift Mode has you covered. Need to find the perfect gift? Don't panic. Try Gift Mode on Etsy now.
Welcome back to The Powers That Be. I hope you enjoyed the commercial break and that you are very excited for our next guest, the one and only Bill Cohan.
Hey, Ben. Always great to be here.
Bill, I know that Peter and John were talking on Media Monday about how badly Paramount whiffed on its earnings. The stock is now down more than 25% since last week, which is really pretty incredible when you consider this is now something like a $11 billion company, maybe even a little bit less today when we're recording this. But I wanted to talk to you about the other big mystery surrounding the future of Paramount, which is the role of Warren Buffett. Berkshire Hathaway, Buffett's conglomerate, bought up a huge amount of the stock last year, and he's now the single biggest shareholder of Paramount. He's got about 15% ownership of the equity in the company. And it's kind of confounding. I mean, I guess we don't know exactly how much he might have gained or lost on that investment. The stock was briefly lower than it is now at one point last year. So we don't know exactly over what time frame he was accumulating his stake. But help me with the logic of this investment. Like, what does the Oracle of Omaha see that the rest of us mortals don't?
Well, Ben, first of all, you're right. It's incredibly down to an $11 billion valuation. I think the only logical explanation for why Warren Buffett now owns 15% of the stock, largest shareholder, and by the way, that includes being larger by 50% than the Redstones, who only own about 10% of the economics of this company, although they control nearly 80% of the voting. So, you know, the expectation here for Sherry combining these companies back in 2019, by the way, after her father had split them apart more than a decade earlier, and of course there was a major lawsuit that got tabled in Delaware court trying to keep them apart for various reasons. She prevailed. The lawsuit got withdrawn. We don't get to go into the gory details of all of that. But Sherry prevailed, combined the companies, and basically it's been sinking like a stone in the equity markets ever since, except for a brief period as a meme stock during the pandemic. I think that the expectation has always been that this is a company that's going to get gobbled up, and that Sherry combined them to make it easier to sell, which, you know, ironically, I think has made it harder to sell, because I think if it had been two separate companies, the old Viacom, the old CBS, it probably would have been easier to sell at least one of those companies. So now I think she's got, like, you know, kind of a poison pill, ironically, with this company, because, you know, the most likely buyers already have a TV network, Disney and Comcast, and they already have a movie studio. So they can't exactly buy Paramount Global and keep the Paramount movie studio or CBS. So to me, this is a regulatory nightmare. It's a mystery. Warren Buffett refuses to answer directly why he bought this company. He bought the stock of this company, spending more than $1 billion to do it. He's had a few times that he's been asked this, most recently on Saturday at the Woodstock for Capitalists annual Berkshire annual meeting in Omaha, and he's not answering it. So we don't know.
Yeah, Buffett's always been a little bit pessimistic about the streaming industry, which, and for good reason. I mean, the currently the economics of that business are terrible. There's too many people there. They're highly competitive. They are struggling to raise prices, and very few of them are profitable.
And nobody's giving up. Like, you know, there's nobody who's saying, oh my God, I'm dropping out of this race. They're all still competing.
You mentioned in your reporting the other day that another potential theory for why Buffett is in this stock is that actually he didn't pick it himself, that he has these underlings, his potential successors, Ted Weschler and Todd Combs. Maybe one of them are the ones who kind of convinced him to get into Paramount. I mean, I assume he would have had to still sign off on that. I mean, him and Charlie Munger are still running this company, right?
Yeah, I mean, but, you know, I think what we've been seeing, including on Saturday, is this desire to put some of these other individuals back, you know, into the limelight, the glow of Warren and Charlie, and it's sort of happening slowly. So you've you know, you've got Greg Abel, who's going to be the new CEO, and then Todd and Ted, who are going to be, I guess, the co-chief investment officers, sort of starting to get into some of the spotlight, not much, but some. And, you know, that's a recognition that, you know, no one gets out alive here. So it's quite possible, this is the other theory, that, you know, this is something those two guys wanted to do. And Warren kind of said, okay, you know, I'm not going to be here at some point anyway. So, you know, you might as well, you know, make your choices, make your bets, and live with them. So this could be part of their, you know, ongoing education. Obviously, they've chosen other stocks in the past. I think they may even be responsible for choosing Apple, which Warren said on Saturday was, you know, their greatest investment ever. So I guess, you know, you win some, you lose some. This one was a clear loser, which I think was frankly entirely predictable. I'm not Warren Buffett, and I don't give investment advice, but I never understood the logic for this company being back together, nor is there a logical buyer at this point, again, unless Sherry wants to sell to some private equity firm.
Well, let's talk about that. I mean, there is still hope for this company. I mean, they do have this studio, which has incredible assets, CBS also an incredible library. Maybe this company doesn't totally make sense together as a streaming play, when the profits they're actually generating are on, of course, the linear TV side and at box office. And both of those have been trending down. I mean, especially pay TV, of course, is in this sort of inexorable state of decline. But if they were able to find buyers for different components of this company, I mean, there's perhaps more value locked up in the company than we can see. I mean, they could sell Paramount Studios to Netflix. They could, as you said, perhaps sell the CBS and the linear assets to somebody like Apollo. Does that feel like it's increasingly inevitable, or do you see other kind of hiccups there?
Well, Ben, it's funny that you ask it that way, because that implies selling it in pieces, which if that's what you're going to do, you should have kept them apart to begin with. Number two, of course, the tax consequences of selling it in pieces are pretty substantial, because I'm sure the tax basis in these assets is extremely low. So it's one thing if you sell the stock of the company for stock, which would probably be a deal that she would do, and then you can, you know, defer the taxes and do some tax planning. If you sell the assets individually with a low tax basis for big gains, then there's going to be a tax at the Paramount Global level, which is not going to be tax efficient, Ben. And so, you know, if you put your M&A advisor hat on for a second, everybody would quickly conclude that that's not the way they want to go. I don't know how Sherry gets out of this. Obviously, Trump were to get reelected, then there'd be a different regulatory environment. Probably right now is probably the worst regulatory environment to try to get a deal like this with a existing competitor slash player done.
Yeah, and the FCC right now is deadlocked, right, where they've got two Democrats and two Republicans. Biden hasn't put in a fifth tie-breaking vote. But I know one of the big questions before that regulatory body is whether they will eventually dispose with this rule preventing you from owning two different broadcast networks. That could unlock a lot of other possibilities.
Yeah, I really don't see that changing. Just like I don't see the rule that prevents a foreigner from buying a television network. You know, those seem sacrosanct to me, but things do change. But I really don't see either one of those changing. And you know, what's the point of owning both anyway? They're both linear TV is in secular decline, and so now you're gonna own two of them. And you know, they have such distinct brands. You can't, like, you know, I think with CNN and NBC, you could sort of mishmash them together, plop them together, and you know, one's your cable, one's your broadcast, and you know, you could make a go of that, and I think that would get regulatory muster. Sherry, you know, had been wanting to do this for so long. You know, she's not really in the business of listening to other people and taking advice, I don't think. You know, she was on a mission, she accomplished the mission, and now she has to sort of live with the consequences of it, which is stock price that's sort of setting into the West.
Of course, you know, sending Paramount Global off to the private equity chop shop is one possibility. But yeah, Sherry, you know, she had this very soap operatic battle with her father to get the company from him. She fought off the girlfriends. She fought off Les Moonves. You know, she ignored.
Unbelievable.
She ignored Bill Cohan's advice and merged these companies together. And now, you know,
she's a Jedi.
She's a Jedi, and she wants some kind of Hollywood ending. And certainly, at least looking at the stock this past week, it feels like maybe that happy ending is sort of slipping away from her.
I mean, Ben, nobody can predict the future, but I, you know, I'm just not feeling it. I just don't see where the opportunity is going to come from.
Yeah, Bill, I have no idea what'll happen, but it was so much fun to talk through all the different possibilities with you. And, you know, we'll be watching, reporting in real time as this thing comes together or doesn't. That's the fun of it. Bill, thanks as always.
Thank you, Ben.
Thanks so much for listening to another episode of The Powers That Be. As a reminder, The Powers That Be is the official podcast of Puck. We'd like to thank Ben Landy, Liz Goff, and Alex Bigler for their editorial and production guidance. If you like what you hear, please share with a friend. It really helps us keep delivering the inside scoop that only Puck can offer. Follow us on Twitter at Puck News. I'm Peter Hamby. See you tomorrow. This has been a presentation of Cadence 13 Studios. Please listen, rate, review, and follow all episodes wherever you get your podcasts. The Powers That Be Daily is executive produced by John Kelly, co-founder of Puck, Chris Corcoran, chief content officer and founding partner of Cadence 13, and produced by Ben Landy, executive editor at Puck.